Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Go For It. I am your host, Paul Gannon. For the next 2 hours, we will be talking sports and having fun doing it. I want all your ideas, all your opinions, and all your beliefs. And, of course, as always, you will get a heavy dose of my opinion. If you have an opinion, the number to call, 646-727-3070. That's 646-727-3070. You can listen to the show at blogtalkradio.com/pgant. That's blogtalkradio.com/pgant. And you can send emails to the show on Twitter at GoForGant. And while you're there on Twitter, give me a follow at GoForGant. Another big show lined up for you today. Expected to be joined by Hall of Famer Willie Rofe. And we're going to get Willie's thoughts on this whole bounty scandal, this audio tape that surfaced with Greg Williams. We're also going to talk to Justin Blaylock of the Atlanta Falcons. Get his thoughts on what's going on, you know, catch up with him in this offseason, what's going on with him. And also, we're going to be joined by former Florida defensive lineman, and NFL draft prospect Jay Howard, and we're going to get Jay's thoughts on this NFL draft as he prepares for this NFL draft. And also, we're going to be joined by AMA National Series racer Shalina Moreta, and we're going to talk to her about what's going on in her season. Her season just got started, so this is motorcycle racing we're talking about, and we're going to talk to her about that. So we got a great show for you. Justin Blaylock of the Atlanta Falcons, Jay Howard, NFL draft prospect, Willie Rofe, and also Shalina Moreta. Make sure you listen to this great show because we're going to talk sports and have fun doing it. I want to start now in the NBA, and just a crazy, crazy, crazy story situation. Dwight Howard, Stan Van Gundy. I mean, these two, it was just a surreal type of thing if you saw it the other day. And I look at it, and I say to myself, and other people have chimed in on this particular topic, and in my opinion, just looking at this whole thing, it's about Dwight Howard in a lot of ways, immaturities and the notion that maybe Dwight, you just play too much, man. And this is a serious situation when, you know, your coach Stan Van Gundy comes out, tells the media, you know what, I've known this, I knew all along that Dwight Howard wants me fired. And how do I know? I got a source. My people in the front office told me. So he didn't specify who in the front office, but somebody in the front office told him. So you look at that whole situation, and you're saying, wow. I mean, and then the funny part about it, Dwight Howard comes out, puts his arm around Stan Van Gundy, and tries to get the attention of Jameer Nelson. He says, Jameer. And you almost got the sense that it was a joke. Like they were playing Stan Van Gundy in some respect. It was some kind of joke. And when you're messing with somebody's life and that's their job, when you're messing with their job, you're messing with somebody's life, you're messing with somebody's money. And when you go to somebody and say, when you go to management and say, you know what, I want this guy fired, you're messing with this guy's money. And then you come and you put your arm around him and you start playing like it's a big joke, some kind of big game. And in some respects, Stan Van Gundy is the brunt of all the jokes in a lot of ways, but he's not. Because it turned out, before Dwight Howard came over, and Dwight Howard didn't even know, before he came over, Stan Van Gundy had told everybody, told the reporters that were there, that guess what? I know that Dwight Howard wants me fired. I already know it. I know it. So the joke in a lot of ways is on Dwight Howard. Dwight Howard in a lot of ways looks bad here. I mean, he looks real bad here. And the funny thing, Chris Broussard of ESPN reported something to the extent of Dwight Howard. Well, there was a report that Dwight Howard obviously wanted Stan Van Gundy fired. Dwight Howard denied it to Chris Broussard of ESPN. And then the next day, that's when Stan Van Gundy came out with his thing. And you get the sense from Stan Van Gundy, he's like, you know what, I'm through with it. You ask me a question, I'm going to tell you the truth. Personally, this is the way I think Stan Van Gundy should have handled it. And because of the way he handled it, he may have troubles going forward with the Orlando Magic. Bottom line is, in that type of situation, you just kind of keep that to yourself. You know you have information. It's just best to just keep it to yourself. And I know you don't want to lie and so on and so forth, but you can easily shoo that question away. You know, reporter asked you, hey, Stan Van Gundy, Dwight Howard, there was reports that Dwight wanted you fired. How would you respond to that? You could just, a simple, I don't know. I mean, well, you know, to me it's just simple, I don't know. I guess you compound the problem by lying again in some respect, because the reality is this. You don't want to put your dirty laundry in the streets. And that's what happened. The dirty laundry is in the streets. The dirty laundry is now in the streets, and everybody knows about it. Everybody knows about it. So what you tried to hide before is now in the streets. Now, if I'm Dwight Howard in this particular situation, I'm mad at management for that, because I came to you in a confidential manner, telling you what I wanted or what I think should happen. And then somebody in management goes back and tells Stan Van about it. I mean, to me, it comes down to this. No one likes a snitch. And the reality is there's a lot of snitching going on in some respect. Dwight Howard goes to management, snitches out his coach, saying, you know, I want his coach fired. Management snitches out Dwight Howard and goes to Stan Van Gundy and tells Stan Van Gundy, you know what, Dwight Howard wants you fired. And then Stan Van Gundy, you know, being a snitch involved in this particular situation, snitches out management and tells the press, the media, that guess what? Yes. Someone in the front office told me that Dwight Howard wanted me fired. So it's just a circle of snitches here. We have a circle of snitches. Dwight Howard goes to management. Management goes to Stan Van Gundy. Stan Van Gundy goes to the media. A circle of snitches. We have just a circle of snitching. And no one likes the snitching. Stan Van Gundy now, if you're a player, how do you trust Stan Van Gundy in this particular situation? If you're a player, how do you trust Stan Van Gundy? If you're Dwight Howard, how do you trust management? How do you trust management now when you came to management, told management, and I would obviously told management, you know what, I don't really want anybody to know this. So he goes to management, tells management whatever he has to tell management, that he wants Stan Van Gundy fired. And then, it's just obviously management tells Stan Van Gundy, and it's just Stan Van Gundy tells the press. Again, the circle of snitches. It's a circle of snitches. Stan Van, Dwight, management, whoever it was in management. We don't know. We don't know. But the Magic, moving forward, they said they're going to move ahead, and they'll be fine. Dwight Howard and Stan Van Gundy said they're going to move ahead and be fine. And the reality is, you look at it, Shaq said it, and I think it's a good point. I don't think Stan Van Gundy again. I think he's going to lose this team. It could go either way, though. You look at it. This could be a thing that motivates this team moving forward, or it could be a thing that just completely shuts this thing down. But again, if you're Dwight Howard, if you're some of the players on the Orlando Magic team, do you trust Stan Van Gundy right now? Do you trust him right now? I'm talking what Shaq said, but in a lot of ways, Shaq is really not objective here. Shaq really does not have any objectivity here, because you could argue that Shaq was a big reason why Stan Van Gundy was fired in Miami. So Shaq really does not have any objectivity here. So, you take his word, but he's not really objective. But I will say this. I will say this in a lot of ways, and I saw this the other day. I heard a reporter for the Miami Herald talk about this, who at the time was a reporter for the Miami Herald, who covered the team, and he talked about how, you know, he questioned Shaq in a lot of ways because Shaq now is saying Pat Riley was the reason. You know, he's basically said Pat Riley noticed that, you know, the players were not listening to Stan Van Gundy and he needed to make a change. Well, if he talked to Shaq, what do you think Shaq told him? You don't think Shaq told him that we need to get rid of Stan Van Gundy? So, I mean, that's the way I look at it. So it's kind of hard for Shaq to be objective here. But let's bring in now a guy that can be objective, Hall of Famer, 11-time Pro Bowler, the one, the only, Willie Rowe. Willie, how are you, sir?
I'm good. But to your point, Stan Van Gundy is the one who has to trust the players and trust Dwight Howard and them to go give him the best effort they're going to give him. Stan Van Gundy didn't ask for Dwight Howard to be traded.
Right.
Dwight Howard asked for Stan Van Gundy, he didn't want him to coach anymore, or whatever he said. So it's not that Stan Van Gundy, if he lost the team, yeah, but the team has to respond and play. And they're not going to, how are they going to make a culture change right now going into the playoffs?
No, I mean, you almost think they should make a coaching change. But at this point, you might as well ride it out. I mean, but in some respect, maybe a culture change is what is needed because it could give the team a spark. It could give the team a spark, kind of like Mike Woodson is doing with the New York Knicks. Could give that team a little spark into the playoffs.
Okay, it would have to be a coach that's right off the bench then. It wouldn't be
right.
A new coach. It'd have to be a new coach that's right there. It'd have to be Patrick Ewing, the one of his assistant coaches then.
Right, definitely. Definitely. But do you think at this point moving forward, the way things transpired here, obviously Stan Van Gundy probably is going to get fired at the end of the season. Unless he goes to the NBA Finals, he's going to get fired at the end of the season because it's obvious that him and Dwight Howard cannot coexist. And Dwight Howard obviously...
I mean, the way it's starting to open now, yeah, but this isn't anything new. They've been drafting back and forth for a few years, I think, now. So, you know, Stan Van Gundy would question him, and then Dwight Howard would play harder and fill up the stat sheet and would rebound the points. But the only problem is Dwight Howard has so much pressure on him to perform. If he doesn't perform at a high level, get everybody involved, and control the paint on the defensive end, that team does not have a good opportunity to win.
Right.
So they just need to figure out how to get players around him where you take the pressure off of him as a player because he just has to play at such a high level for that team to be able to compete every night.
Right, definitely. I mean, he does have to play at a high level, and there is a lot of pressure on him. And I look at this whole thing, part of this is kind of immaturity on Dwight Howard's part, especially knowing that you went to management and told management that, you know, Stan Van Gundy, that they need to get rid of Stan Van Gundy, they need to fire Stan Van Gundy. For you to kind of put your arm around him and kind of make a joke of the situation, it's not really funny because this is a man's livelihood talking about Stan Van Gundy, and in some respect you're playing with his money. So, I mean, that's immature on his part to kind of put his hands around this, put his arm around him, and almost kind of try to make a mockery of him in some respect.
Well, but I don't think that's something that happened right now. I think that's something that happened. I think if you let it be said, it, you know, before the season started, he might have went and said something about that. I don't think that's something he's been saying to management at this time. I think that's something that was said before the season started. But so that's old news. But right now, you know, Dwight Howard, obviously, we've seen Dwight Howard and some of his actions doing, like on the bench when he didn't play good against the Knicks and him smiling and making references. I mean, these kids are making a lot of money, Paul. It's guaranteed. He knows he's got the upper hand. Look at the way Andrew Bynum acts now. I mean, you have a young man that's making a lot of money. I mean, you're paying these guys, you know, 15, 16, 20 million, 18 million a year. What are you going to tell them? You know, that they're locked in and they know that they got the upper hand. So it's nothing that they can really do with Dwight Howard. If they trade him, he gets paid. If he stays, he gets paid.
And to your point, it's almost like a guy who has the upper hand or a female who has the upper hand in a relationship. You know, they can do pretty much anything they want to do to you. The reality is they have the upper hand.
Yes.
You need them more than they need you. And so, and in some respect, the way Bynum is acting and the way Dwight Howard is acting, I mean, that's what it comes down to. They have the upper hand, And there's really nothing to the Lakers in a lot of ways. There's really nothing the Magic can do. The Magic needs Dwight Howard more than Dwight Howard needs them. And that's the bottom line. And, I mean, moving forward, looking at this whole situation, if you're Dwight Howard, would you trust management again? Could you trust management again? Because somebody in management told Stan Van Gundy about this.
Well, I don't know who he was sitting in the room with, and you know, his questions about what happened, but I just think it's time for the Orlando Magic, because of everything that they've been through with Dwight Howard, I think it's time for them to figure out what they're going to do with Dwight Howard next year, and I think they probably need a coaching change too. So I just think they need a new, you know, they have a new arena. I would like to see them trade for a real good basketball player, because you can't have that franchise with that beautiful new arena down there without having a marquee player. So
right.
If they're going to trade Dwight Howard, they have to get a marquee player in there. I just think it's time for Orlando to go in a different direction and get some new blood in there as far as a coach. And I think it's about time for them to part ways with Dwight Howard.
And it's only going to get worse for the Magic. It's just been announced that Hedo Turkoglu is now out for the season with a facial fracture. So, I mean, it's only going to get worse for the Magic, and we'll see how they finish. But they're going to make the playoffs, but the thing is, we'll see if they can get out of the first round. That's going to be a challenge for them. Now, Willie, looking at now, we go to the New Orleans Saints, and the Greg Williams audio came out this past week. Him the night before the 49ers game, him talking about players going after Michael Crabtree, his ACL, and going after the head of Kyle Williams and things of that nature. To me, I've never been in an NFL locker room, but I would think this is almost kind of common speech to kind of rev people up, get people going. I mean, some of the things, obviously you talk ACL, you know, obviously that's not a good situation, but is his speech almost common?
No. I listened to that last night. I wanted to listen to that audio last night before we talked. And, no, he's talking about going after the head of the quarterback. He's talking about going after Frank Gore's head.
Mm-hmm.
You cut the head, the body will follow. I understand the defensive guys are saying that's commonplace. I'm not a defensive player, so I wouldn't be in the meeting room. But when the league is talking about these concussions and everything going on, and you're talking about going out the head of all these guys, you know, ACL is one thing, going out the leg. But when you're talking about going out the headshots, basically, of these guys, and the body will follow, you can't really come with that tone in this day and age. Now, you want to say you're going to play physical, you're going to play hard, I can accept that. But you don't need to make references toward people's head, because that's illegal to do that. So why would you reference that?
Well, and you can make the argument that, I mean, here's the reality.
In today's NFL,
right.
You know, you don't say go after, and I think they're harsh on Sean Payton, but you can't say we're going to go after these guys' heads. You can't do that. I don't think you can do that. I'll argue
this. I mean, granted, you talk about head in this day and age, you talk about going after people's ACL this day and age, it's a whole different ballgame. But I will say this. Sometimes, I mean, playing football, it's a physical game. In some respect, you're out there, not necessarily to hurt somebody, but you are there to inflict some sort of pain on someone. Now, I mean, this is the hurt business in a lot of ways. So in order to get somebody to that point where they want to hurt somebody or at least inflict pain on somebody, doesn't it take sometimes those type of things to rev a person up? Doesn't it take a coach to speak maybe in that manner to rev some players up?
Well, okay, if you want to say that, but obviously it didn't do too much revving up because San Francisco went out and scored 36 the next day.
That's a good point.
But the point I'm making is this, Paul, is that I played football. I was injured trying to play football when I was with the Saints my last year. And I remember we played against Indianapolis when Coach Moore was coaching them, and my knee was hurt. And I didn't know how bad my knee was hurt, so I will speak from experience. And I had a defensive lineman come and hit me in my right leg. Now, I'm out there trying to play on a torn ACL. well, I'm trying to play. And that was the last game that I did try to play against Indianapolis in 2001 before I told him that I will go up to and see Dr. James Andrews and see what's wrong with my knee. Obviously, something's not right with it, but I never had a torn ACL. So if you're hurt out there playing, that's one thing. You can't play football hurt. But we're not. But if a guy has an injury and he's on the injury report, or if a guy's out there playing hurt and he starts limping around, we're studying guys the whole game. If I'm playing Chuck Smith with some guy during the course of the game and he starts limping around, so yeah, I might take a couple shots down low at his legs, not his ACL, but at his legs and see how he's doing. See how his body responds, because if he's injured and he's out there trying to play, he's going to slow down eventually in the course of that game. But to another point, we're not referencing saying, I haven't heard, coaches don't need to be saying, we're going out here to go after somebody's head. No, I mean, that's and I heard what Winston said, that that's what 95% of the people say. Well, yeah, playing physical, playing hard, yes, but not roughing the head of the body.
Okay. I mean, the reality is now, this day and age, you're almost going to – everybody's just going to have – it's going to have to be a whole shift. It's going to be a transformation. You're not going to be able to talk the way you used to talk and say the things that you used to say. And, I mean, that's the way it's going to have to be moving forward, especially with this. But I would just contend this. The reality, I think, I'm not saying every coach talks about going after ACLs and going after people's heads and so on and so forth, but I will say this. I will say this about this. You look at it, to me it just comes down to this. Greg Williams, Sean Payton, and the New Orleans Saints just got caught. Everybody speeds, but everybody does not get caught, and I think that's what happened here. They just got caught.
No. Let's go here, Paul. You know what I reference this to? Well, with Sean Payton's situation coming up is, they didn't get caught. They got warned before they got caught. It's like you being in the classroom and the teacher keeps telling you, all right, if you keep, when you're a little kid in the third grade, if you keep being the class clown and messing up this class, you're going to be on this board writing at recess. I will not act up in class. You know how they make you sit there and write it. You got to watch the kids play outside, but you up in the classroom watching, writing while they're playing on recess. Well, that's what's going to be happening to Sean Payton this year, because in certain game situations, he's going to have to watch his team play, and he's not going to be able to interject the plays that he would want to put in these certain down the distance, and Drew Brees is going to have to improvise. They got warned a couple of years ago not to do it, and we know how Roger Goodell is. And if he warns you not to do it, he's watching you to see if you're going to do it, and you did it anyway. So it's not the fact that they were just called out, selfishly out of everybody's league. Greg Williams obviously had a history with doing this, and they warned him about it, and they did it anyway. So, like I said, I think what happened with Sean Payton is wrong to a certain, the length of the suspension, and we don't know when Greg Williams is coming, especially after that speech came out. We don't know when he's gonna let him back in the league, but
yeah, he may not.
But he did warn them a year or two ago not to do this.
But I will say this: we all get warned. We get warned at times from cops to stop speeding, but we do it anyway.
What I mean? We're talking about football. We're not talking about and we might speed every other day, but you don't get dumb. Everybody, I text sometimes when I'm driving, when I'm not supposed to, or when I'm stopped or whatever. So you always do stuff in the car on an everyday basis. Yeah, but you get warm, but that's not the same as what we're talking about. It's not the same there.
It'd be
a little worse than speeding is what I'm saying. It would be like, there's a bump. There's a bump in the road, and you know the bump's in the road, but if you hit the bump the wrong way, you know that you can get in an accident, okay? So it'd be like you saying, all right, I'm going to go fast over this bump, even though I know I'm supposed to slow down when I come around that curve. Bobby Petrino, when I'm supposed to slow down when I come around that curve when that motorcycle, I ain't got no helmet on, and it's some gravel on the road, Well, I don't slow down on that curve, and I hit that curve, and the bike slips. Well, I knew I should have slowed down before I hit that curve anyway.
No, I mean, you can't. What happened to the Saints in a lot of ways, I agree. You got warned. You did it anyway. I mean, you really don't have any sympathy from that angle. You got warned. You did it anyway. I guess the reality, I guess where I'm going in terms of just the whole culture of bounties in general, not as said or unsaid. I think it is a culture with it. There was something that it did happen. It did go on in the NFL and has been going on for years within the NFL. I mean,
and I will say this: I don't know. I played on two teams. It wasn't a bounty like that. I told you it was more of a thing where a special teams guy, somebody makes a big play, we get some money. And then you got to understand, for offensive players and for defensive players, they have incentives for getting certain numbers. So
mm-hmm.
My last year, or one of the years I remember with Kansas City, Dante Hall needed a certain amount of catches, or Eddie Kennison needed to do certain things at the end of the season. Some teams are good about it, will let a guy try to get them, and some teams will pull them out and won't let them get those incentives. Well, the officer, Al Saunders, purposely concentrated on going to those guys, and Trent Green knew that they needed certain numbers to get the incentives, so we gave them the ball to reach those incentives.
Right.
So you already have incentive based up in your contract, and these defensive players, if they get certain sacks or certain numbers, they're already going to get incentives in their contracts. So they know that what they have to do during the course of the year and what numbers they need to attain to reach those incentives. So those incentives should be enough for them to go out there and play hard, is my point, week in, week out. Now, we start talking about guys on the roster that aren't starters, that aren't making that kind of money. Well, a lot of them would have incentive too. You know, that's a little different story because they're not making as much money. But it should be some incentives in the contract for a guy to want to go out and play harder to reach those goals. And, you know, the game should be played tough and hard, but the game should be played, within the final of playing football and not purposely going after a guy. If a guy's out there injured, it's a different story. He shouldn't be out there playing football.
We're talking to the newest member of the Pro Football Hall of Fame, Hall of Fame inductee Willie Rofe, 11-time Pro Bowler, all that good stuff. And Willie, looking at it now, we talked about riding around curves and unfortunately, you know, not doing what you're supposed to do around that curve. And that's Bobby Petrino. I mean, the accident started out as a one-passenger accident. Miraculously, it turned to a two-person accident, and that second person happened to be a 25-year-old football employee, someone who he had an inappropriate relationship with. What's going to happen to Petrino? I mean, he's had a lot of success at Arkansas. You're an Arkansas boy. Do you think Petrino needs to get fired?
No, he doesn't need to get fired. I mean, I think a lot of this, some of this stuff goes on all the time. You know, it's a sad, touchy situation. First of all, I'm just happy that Coach Petrino is all right after that accident. He should have been wearing his helmet. You know, these coaches at these universities are in a real tough situation. I mean, just think about it. Bobby Petrino is up in Fayetteville. He's making almost $4 million. You know, other than the basketball coach, you know, who might be making $1 million. Well, they just hired the coach who's at Missouri, who's real good, Mike Anderson. So he's making a couple million. But other than anybody up there, even the president, you know, Bobby Petrino is the biggest fish there. Some of his assistant coaches are making, you know, good money, but not like he's making. So, you know, he's got a target on him, and he has to understand what he's dealing with. And I know once you've been with a woman, Paul, for a long time and things have changed over the years, he wanted some excitement and stuff like that. But, I don't know if he met her in the parking lot and was riding around. And you got to understand, up there by Fayetteville, it's a lot, it's hilly, it's a lot of curves. You're up in the mountains, you're by the Ozarks. It's a lot of different terrain around there. And, you know, I just don't understand the part about him riding around with no helmet on. I mean, people are going to notice who he is. riding around, you know, 20 miles outside of Fayetteville. So I just think he could have been a little smarter about it. But I think, you know, at some of these universities with these coaches making as much money as they are, these football coaches with these big-time football programs, and he's taking that football team to a top-five team, that this type of stuff is going to go on because, you know, women are attracted to power and fame and to winning. And Pacino's done a hell of a job up there. And, you know, like I said, I don't think they can let him go with a top-five program. It's just making sure the teammates, the players respect him is what he's, you know, got to make sure he keeps that.
I understand the terms of temptation and all that. I mean, obviously his level of temptation would be different than my level of temptation. But, you know, at the end of the day, he is a married man of four.
Okay.
You know, with four kids. So, I mean.
But their kids are pretty much grown, right?
I believe so. I mean, he's 51 years old. I don't know the ages of their kids. But
okay.
He's 51 years old, so you would assume that they're, to your point, fairly grown. But, you know, we still can't give it we can't give the man a pass here because at the end of the day, he is a married man. I mean, and he's 51 years old. The woman works for
okay.
him, essentially. She's
okay.
25
okay.
years
he's,
old.
He's married in the sense of the word, let's say married. But,
okay.
but let's be realistic. If he's riding around with this girl on his bike, you know, some of these marriages at certain points, Paul, are just kind of marriages of convenience. It's a marriage.
No,
of,
I understand that.
For me to look good in the university, for them, you know, I have to have this image, and you know, it's good to be a man, a family man. So a lot of guys are betraying this image, and you know that, you know, you got all these cute girls that are. If you go to most of those football, even in Louisiana Tech and some of these smaller D1 schools, when you go in their offices and go around there, they're going to have some very attractive young ladies that are going to be around those athletes and around those coaches. Now, if you got a coach that's been married a while, and let's say you know the wife isn't as attractive, or you know it's just a different situation now, and you have these cute young ladies in their early 20s. I'm sure if they were in a situation that it could happen to a lot of guys.
No, I understand that part. I mean,
okay.
I'm not going to judge him. I'm not going to judge him. But I will say this. He is a married man. I mean, whether it's a good marriage, bad marriage, he's a married man. And so you're a leader of a university and the leader of the football program. You know, people send their kids away to your program. You're supposed to be a role model of some sort, whether you want to be or whether you like to be or whether – I mean, the reality is you are a role model. So you have to set the standard in some respect.
Do you think this will hurt him with recruiting? Do you think this will hurt the university in recruiting?
No, I think it'll be fine. But, I mean, I think people forget about that kind of stuff. But, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, would you send your child to Bobby Petrino?
I mean, he's got a top-five program. I mean, he's done a hell of a job coaching, so I wouldn't hold him accountable for that action, because you know and I know that this goes on a lot at those universities. It's just a matter of, you know, he got caught. The only reason he got caught is because of that motorcycle accident. So, you know, if it wasn't for the motorcycle accident, and he tried to say the girl wasn't on the bike to begin, you know, after the accident was over, he wouldn't have got caught anyway. Do you think it will end with him and the girl? I mean, I don't think that changed anything. I think Bobby Petrino gets a slap on the hand, and I think the girl might not be able to work over there with the team anymore, where he had just hired her. But I mean, think about Nick Saban and some of these coaches making $5-6 million a year, man, and they're at these colleges in these little areas. You know, I mean, the girls see statues of the guy of them on campus, and I mean, you got to think about it. They know what these guys are making.
These
guys are making, man, and they know that these guys have been married for a while, and you know, with that kind of money in those areas, and pretty much those coaches like Petrino and these coaches at these major universities. They're not having to pay for a lot of food, a lot of anything. I'm pretty sure he can go anywhere he wants and get free meals and get whatever he wants. So, you know, out of that money he's making, how much is he really having to spend?
That's a good point. That's a good point. That's definitely a good
point. So he's got something to give away, is my point. If he wants to share it.
And it looks like he's sharing it with a lot of different people and money and other things. So he's having a good old time out there in Arkansas. And we'll see what happens. Willie, it was a pleasure talking to you, sir. We wish
you
nothing but the best of luck.
All right.
Let's do this again.
Okay. Take it.
The great Willie Rofe, 11-time Pro Bowler, and Bob Petrino is having a good old time, and we'll see what happens. But, I mean, again, he is a role model, whether he wants to be or whether he is a role model. And I'm kind of bottom line, and you're a leader of men. And so, well, boys, you're turning into men, so they need a positive role model to look at. And I'm not sure Bobby Petrino in some respect is that guy, but we are all flawed individuals. We are all flawed. We all have issues. So I guess that is his issues. You're listening to Go For It on blogtalkradio.com.
Corey Almeida, a.k.a. Corey Live, host of Pizzerica on the Hub and warm-up host for American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. And right now, you are listening to Go For It on Blog Talk Radio with my man Paulie G and Jeremy. Get it!
And that's what we do here on Go For It. We talk sports. We have fun doing it. And we're going to be talking some more sports this time with Atlanta Falcons guard, the one, the only, Justin Blaylock. Justin, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, thanks. How about yourself?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Justin, you look at the Falcons season, another trip to the playoffs and another early exit for you guys, this time in the wild card round to the New York Giants. What can you guys take from the game against the Packers 2 seasons ago and the game against the Giants this year, moving forward in 2012?
You know, there's not a whole bunch that you can really take out of something like that. I mean, obviously, you kind of leave that stinging taste in your mouth where, you know, you want to go, if it motivates you to work hard in the off season or whatever it needs, you know, you need to do to, you know, make you feel better, you know, great if you take that from it. But, I mean, just looking at it again, there's so many things, you know, we didn't perform well. And, you know, that's, I mean, at the end of the day, all that really matters.
Right.
I can't sit around and say this happened or that happened. We just didn't play well enough. And, you know, obviously, we've had a good string of, you know, years of making the playoffs and things of that nature, having good records and whatnot, but we're trying to have some staying power once we get to the playoffs.
And looking at you guys, Justin, focusing on the offensive line now, you guys struggled early on, allowing 13 sacks after the first 3 games, but you only allowed 13 sacks the final 13 games. What was the reason for the turnaround?
You know, it's really hard to put a finger on something like that. I mean, a lot of it does have to do, you know, with our play. I mean, but some of it's also, you know, schemes and things of that nature. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that go into, you know, protecting a quarterback, and a lot of that has to do with, you know, the run game as well. So everything really, you know, ties together. It's not just a matter of, you know, only – it's not like we just went to, you know, pass blocking school overnight and, you know, all of a sudden got better. It has a lot to do with, you know, so many things that had to happen for a play to be successful.
Right. And you look at it this year, 2012, you guys are going to have a new offensive line coach, Pat Hill. What have you heard about Coach Hill? Have you spoken to him at all? Justin? I I think we lost Justin Blaylock. Hopefully he'll call back. But you look at the Atlanta Falcons, they do have a new offensive line coach. Pat Hill would be the new guy this year for the ball club. Hopefully we can get him back on. But you look at the Falcons, a team played well. Two seasons ago, they were the number one seed going into the playoffs. And this year, they go in the wild card round against the New York Giants, and they lose the first round. We're going to try to get Justin back on. But, again, the Atlanta Falcons is an interesting team. And team is a very talented team. A team a lot of people had going to the Super Bowl. I mean, a lot of people had this ball club going to a Super Bowl. They had this ball club being one of the better ball clubs in the league. Let's take a commercial break now, see if we can get Justin back on.
Corey Almeida, a.k.a. Corey Live, host of Picturica on the Hub and warm-up host for American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. And right now, you are...
Let's bring him back in, Justin Blaylock. Justin, how are you, sir?
I'm still doing great. We're going to have to make a call to AT&T right after this and
Definitely. You need to make the switch. Justin, we talked about the new offensive line coach you guys are going to have, Pat Hill. What have you heard about Coach Hill?
I've actually had the chance to meet him and talk with him several times already. I think he's going to be great for our line. Just his philosophies and, the way he approaches the game, I think might just be the breath of fresh air that we need.
Right. And looking at it last season, Justin, you guys got – your offensive line got a reputation around the league for being dirty, fair or unfair. Are you bothered by that label, and is it true?
It doesn't bother me one bit. I know guys around the league. You know, we talk all the time. I was up in New York just this past week with a couple D linemen, and no problems. Any of that nature. But I don't think it is necessarily the case. I mean, I've been playing for a long time. I've got maybe two fines my whole career, and one of them was for uniform. So I don't think that that's the case. We play hard. There's no question about that. But, there's plenty of defensive linemen that play just as hard as we do. No one complains if they run 20 yards downfield and tackle a running back from behind and force collar them. I mean, this is part of the game. So if we can do our part to keep them from doing something like that, so be it.
We're talking to Falcons guard Justin Blaylock. And Justin, another solid season for yourself. I mean, I look at you. You're a guy that's not too far away from a Pro Bowl. What do you need to do or have you done in this offseason to kind of take that next step?
It's really tough because we're the one position that doesn't really have any kind of metrics. No one really can keep track of our stats. So it's kind of tough to really get your foot in the door there, especially when there's so many good people at my position, especially in our conference. But even with that being said, I've approached this year the same way I approach every year. Try to work on technique as much as possible, and obviously getting my body in shape, to handle the rigors of a 16 game season, hopefully 20 game season with the postseason.
Right. And Justin, we talked about the reputation that some of you guys are getting for the Falcons for being dirty. Speaking of dirty, the New Orleans Saints, the audio came out this week. Greg Williams, before a playoff game, he talked about going after Michael Crabtree's ACL. He talked about going after the head. You played the Saints two times last season. You played them two times since you've been in the league. When you hear that kind of talk, as an offensive player, are you bothered by that?
It doesn't really get to me. And it's really not even something I think about because, I mean, I know guys on that team, you know, defensive players on that team, know them well. And it's not really something that even crosses my mind. I mean, it's a violent, physical sport. Things will happen. I don't feel like, you know, people need any extra motivation to go out and hit someone hard. I mean, that's what you're getting paid to do already. So,
right.
You know, all that kind of stuff, you know, I think it's really just to get guys motivated, fired up, what have you. You know, I never really sat back and, you know, been in a position where I was, you know, fearful or something for my safety out there.
Right.
You know, more than, you know, just what comes with the game as it is. So, you know, it's a really tough position to be in, you know, for those guys and people that are handing out punishments and things of the nature. But, I mean, I definitely don't envy them.
Definitely not. Justin, you're a guy who's doing big things, not only on the field, but off the field with your foundation, the Justin Blaylock Foundation. Talk about the motivation behind the foundation.
Well, I mean, the biggest thing, you know, to me is education. It's something that's really been stressed throughout my life. And I've been very privileged and fortunate throughout my life to have parents that were interested in how I did in school and wanted, you know, the best of things for me. And, you know, through education, you know, they were able to provide those things for me. And, you know, I just hope that I can, in turn, give that back to some kids that don't have, you know, the opportunities that I was afforded, you know, growing up, and maybe make things, you know, a little bit easier for them.
Right. And where can we find information about this foundation?
I'm all over. Got a, you know, justinblaylock.com. That'd be the easiest way, and you can click on links, you know, for my website, for my foundation, everything from there. So, I mean, if anyone has any interest in that, there's lots of things going on as well. We do, you know, workshops for the kids, whether it be SAT or life skills or entrepreneurship, football camps. I mean, all sorts of things. Really just trying to, you know, help these children out. They got it really tough these days. So, you know, anything that I can do to kind of lend a helping hand.
And Justin, in a lot of ways, offensive linemen, they live a life of anonymity. No one really gets to know you guys. I want to play a game with you called Getting to Know You. You ready to play?
I hope so.
Justin, if you could if you could appear in any music video, and I took this from your website, JustinBlaylock.com, if you can appear in any music video with any star, who would it be?
You know, the thing is, I made that, I put that up a while ago, so a couple things might have changed, but I still got a role with Alicia Keys.
Okay. Why Alicia?
She's a very talented musician, which, I mean, a lot of people in the pop scene aren't really playing instruments these days, and, I mean, just look at her.
I guess enough said. Who is Justin Blaylock's favorite actress?
Scarlett Johansson.
Okay. What is in Justin Blaylock's iPod right now? What kind of music is in there?
Oh, my God, there's a little bit of everything. You know, I got hip-hop, R&B, being from Texas, I got to have, you know, some country in there. There's all sorts of stuff on my iPod. And the best thing is I just have like a million Pandora channels. So when I get tired of one, I just move to the next.
On to the next one. If you could have one actor play the lead in the Justin Blaylock story, who would it be?
Oh, man. Really tough because they don't have any really big guys. Maybe like Anthony Anderson or somebody like that. I mean,
okay, Anthony.
Yeah, that's somebody a good with a little size to him.
That is a good one, Anthony Anderson. Okay. You guys resemble each other a little bit.
A little bit.
Everybody, make sure you go to justinblaylock.com. A lot of great things about this man. You can see some of the questions, some of the things that he likes to do. Go to justinblaylock.com. A great foundation this guy has going on. Make sure you support some of the great things he is doing. Justin, it was a pleasure talking to you, man. We would love to do this again.
So
good luck in the off season.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
All right, same to you.
Justin Blaylock, guard, Atlanta Falcons. And so Justin wants Anthony Anderson to play him. And so I guess that would be pretty cool to have an Anthony Anderson play him. Very cool, actually. And so we'll see what happens with the Justin Blaylock story, the Atlanta Falcons, a team, again, that is very close to winning a Super Bowl. This is a team that's very close to winning a Super Bowl. Can they do it? Will they do it? So, I mean, you look at it, you look at the Atlanta Falcons, and they're a team that they're close, but can they get over the top? And that's the problem first year against the, and to their point, to their credit, I guess, they did lose to the two Super Bowl champions the last two seasons, the Packers in the divisional round and in the wild card round. They lost to the New York Giants, and both of those teams went on to win Super Bowls. So maybe it's not a bad thing what happened to the Falcons. I mean, it is what it is in a lot of ways, but they did lose to the eventual Super Bowl champions. But I think going into next season, you have to say they are one of the favorites in the NFC. You have to put them up there. I'm not saying they're going to win it, but you have to say they're one of the favorites in the NFC next season. You definitely have to say that. But we'll see. We'll definitely see what happens. But the Falcons are a team that you have to watch in 2012. Definitely you're going to have to watch them in 2012. And I want to go back to this Greg Williams thing. And again, the audio surfaced. And it's out there, him talking about going after. And let's go specific to some of the things he said. You know, talking about Frank Gore. We got to do everything in the world to make sure we kill Frank Gore's head. We want him running sideways. We want his head sideways. Wow. Talking about Kendall Hunter, little 32, we're going to knock the bleep out of him. Alex Smith, every single one of you, before you get off the pile, affect the head early. Affect the head. Continue to touch and hit the head. On Kyle Williams, we need to find out in the first two series of the game, that little wide receiver number 10, about his concussion. We need to bleep, put a lick on him right now. He needs to decide. He needs to bleep being decide. On Michael Crabtree, we need to decide whether Crabtree wants to be a fake prima donna or he wants to be a tough guy. We need to find out. He becomes human when he bleeped takes out that outside ACL. On Vernon Davis, we need to decide how many times we can bull rush and we can bleep put Vernon Davis's ankles over the pile. So a lot of bleeps here. And again, it's a pregame speech. It is a pregame speech. And I said this to Willie and I'll say it again. Sometimes in order to get a person to that point where they want to do, not necessarily harm, but inflict some kind of pain on another player, or another person, you really have to pump them up. You really have to pump them up. And so that's what happens here. That's what happens before a game. Guys, coaches trying to pump up the other player, trying to get the player ready to go out and hurt somebody. Not hurt, but put some pain. Hurt is the wrong word. Inflict some pain on some people. So we'll see. We'll see. But, I mean, Greg Williams, your chances of probably coaching in the NFL are done. probably done. Those chances are done. Sean Payton, whatever chance you had of getting an appeal and with your appeal of getting it shortened, those are done as well. Mickey Loomis, 8 games. Well, you're going to have 8 games because it's not going to be shortened. It's just because of this. I mean, this is just the worst time for this to come out. This is the worst time if you're Sean Payton, if you're Greg Williams. This is the worst thing that could have happened to you. The worst thing. The absolute worst thing. The worst thing that could happen to you at the worst time. Awful timing. Awful timing. Just awful timing. I mean, this is the worst thing that could happen to you. The worst thing that could happen to you. And if you feel bad for those guys, but at the same time, just like Willie Roque pointed out, they were warned. So you really don't feel all that bad for them. They were warned. You were warned. They were warned. And they did it anyway. They did it anyway. I warned you, and you did it anyway. I warned you, and you did it anyway. You did it anyway. That's just win-win-win. It's just like if you tell your kid, you know, do not go over the line. Do not go out of his yard. And they go out the yard, guess what? The punishment becomes worse. The punishment becomes worse because you told them. You told them, and they defied you. They defied you. And that defiance is what cost Sean Payton a season, which caused Mickey Loomis 8 games, and which caused Greg Williams to be suspended indefinitely. And with this audio now surfacing, this may cause Greg Williams to never get a job in the NFL again. But coaches do stick with other coaches, and coaches tend to give opportunities to other coaches. So there's still that possibility he will get that opportunity. There's still an opportunity. There's still a chance he will get that opportunity. But we'll have to see. We'll have to see. But his career, maybe as a defensive coordinator, is now over. His days as a defensive coordinator in this league is now over. It's over. It's over. It's now over. So you look at this whole situation and you feel bad for Greg Williams, but you don't. You feel bad for Sean Payton, but you don't. You feel bad for Mickey Loomis, but you don't. And the thing is, when you and various players said various things, but when you start talking about ACLs, and Mike Orvin has some interesting comments about it, you know, when he talks about ACLs, it kind of made him sick to his stomach. When he heard the talk of ACLs, it made him sick to his stomach. Made him sick to his stomach. Made him sick to his stomach when he heard that. At least that's what he said. Made him sick to his stomach. Let's bring in now actor, the one, the only, Crispin Glover.
Hello.
Crispin, how are you, sir?
Good. How are you doing? Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can hear you.
Okay. I'm very well.
Thanks for joining us.
Glad to do it. I'm about to start touring with some films and that I've made and a live show that I perform. I'm going to be in Champaign, Illinois, April 11th and 12th at the Art Theater. And then I'm going to be up in Toronto, April 14th and 15th at the TIFF. Bell Lightbox Theater. Then May 18th and 19th, I'm going to be in Vienna, Austria, at Admiral Kino. And then on June 12th and 13th, I'm going to be in Madrid, Spain, at La Casa Encendida, which is another one of these art house theaters, which are the types of theaters that I perform my live show and show my my films that I've made in. Does your audience reach out into Austria and Spain, or is it more
It's worldwide. It's worldwide.
Good, good. Well, people can find out more information as to when I'll be where by going on to CrispinGlover.com. There's a newsletter that they can sign up for, and it lets people know as I tour around with these films and shows that I've been performing for the last, it's year seven of touring now.
Okay.
So it's good to come on to shows like yours and get the word out. I also have a Twitter, Crispin Glover Twitter, and an official Crispin Hellion Glover Facebook page. But the very best way to get the information is going on CrispinGlover.com.
And so, talk about some of the things that you will be performing on tour.
Well, I've taken old books from the 1800s and reworked them and turned them into different books from what they originally were, and they're heavily illustrated books. I started making these books in the 80s and publishing them. The first book I published was a book called Rat Catching, which is a study in the art of rat catching, plus something extra. Again, this is a very heavily illustrated book. And when I first published it in 1988, people said to me, well, you know, you're an author, you should really have a book reading. This is what published authors do. But the books were so heavily illustrated that I knew if I just kind of stood and read the words, the illustrations really helped to move the story along.
Okay.
So I knew that I would have to have a visual representation of the books. And it wasn't until 1993 that there was a film festival up in Olympia, Washington, and they had a kind of a retrospective of the work that I'd done as an actor at that time. And I realized this would be a good time to put the slideshow together, as I call it, Crispin Hellion Glover's big slideshow, and to perform it. And the first time I ever, I picked eight different books. It lasted an hour. And the first time I ever performed it, it went really well. And I've been performing it off and on ever since. And really, I started realizing it would be a good way for me to self-distribute my own films that I've been making.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I've done. And since then, I've developed a second slideshow that also has eight different books, and it's also an hour long. So I have two different feature films that I've made that are part one and two of what will be a trilogy. And so on subsequent nights, I perform either Crispin Hellion Glover's Big Slideshow Part 1 or Crispin Hellion Glover's Big Slideshow Part 2, and I perform them before the two different feature films.
How much fun is this for you to kind of bring your books to life, if you will?
Well, I do like performing the show. It's what I like about it, there are a number of aspects that I like. One of them is just that it's something I never – it came about organically. I did not – it wasn't something like I planned to do from a young age or anything. It just – it came about as logical steps to come forward. And what I'm happy about is that I have basically I've been able to recoup on these feature films that I'm very passionate about that I've made – by this kind of unusual self-distribution technique. When I say that I've recouped, the way I've really done it is really I bring in more money by the live performance aspect of my shows than by the box office of the film. And then I have a book signing at the end after a Q&A, and of course I sell the books at the shows, so I bring some income in from that. And really 50% of the recoupment has been by the live shows that I perform. 25% of it has been by the box office from the films, and 25% has been by the book sales. So, you know, in a certain way, I actually haven't recouped entirely the specifically from the box office of the films, but that doesn't matter. All I really wanted to make sure of was that I recouped, which means that it makes sense for me to be able to make another film. But I do enjoy performing the shows, especially that it's my own. These are my own creations, and I feel and people enjoy the shows. It seems to all work out well.
Now, do you take more pleasure in making and writing these books, or do you get more pleasure performing? More pleasure writing or performing?
Well, when I made the books, they were not made to perform. I made them because I enjoyed making them and showing them to friends. And I had no concept when I made most of these books in the 1980s and very early 90s. So I didn't conceive of them to be performed or to be published, but it just came into logical steps that I should publish them and then that I should perform them. And happily, they've all made their own sense. It made sense when I made them as original art objects, so to speak, or stories. And then it made sense when they were published as books that people could own individually. And then it's made sense to perform them and showcase them in that light. So it's a funny thing, because I made these, you know, when I was, you know, many years ago, more than 25 years ago, a lot of them. And I almost look at it as a letter to myself as a younger person to myself now. It's interesting that it's had such a strong and positive impact on my own life.
Wow.
I'm surprised by it, because it was not what I was expecting when I was making them. But it's a good thing. It's a good thing.
We're talking to actor Crispin Glover.
I'm very passionate about making the films, which I haven't really talked about so much, but that's really where that same kind of energy that went into making the books has gone into, and these are unusual feature films that, you know, the kind of art house movie distribution model that existed in the 70s and 80s more really has fallen away. And so this kind of way of distributing my own personal films is also something I'm very happy about, that it's that it works essentially as a way to pay myself back for the investment that I've made,
right.
Or really the audiences are the people that are paying me back for the investment I made. So I have a very personal bond really with the people that come to my shows, and I'm grateful to the people. And, you know, I have a Q&A after the film is played, and then I have the book signing. So I genuinely get to know the people that are coming to my shows that want to come up and say hello. And it's pleasant. I feel actually like it's a much more in a certain way it's a very pleasant way of having your film work where you're talking to the people that are genuinely enjoying your film, as opposed to a corporation which pays you and then you're kind of disconnected from the audience.
Right. In some respect, you take out the middleman.
Absolutely, yes.
And how is life on the road for you?
Well, I've really been doing this for this is year 7 of touring, and it's become much more. I've come to realize it's a huge part of my day to day existence, my life. I used to be in like a single city for long periods of time. I'd be in Los Angeles for many months at a time. But I own property in the Czech Republic now as well, and this is where I'll continue shooting and making my own films. And I'm overseeing building sets for my next production there. Between being in L.A., I own a house in Los Angeles, being at my property in the Czech Republic, being on the road touring with my shows and films, or acting in other people's films, I'm very rarely in a city for more than 2 weeks at a time now. And that has effects on personal life, on relationships, and
right.
and that sort of thing. But ultimately, I'm glad of it. It's worth it. A touring lifestyle is not necessarily an easy lifestyle.
Right.
But I'm not going to complain. Ultimately, it's a privileged position to be in the entertainment industry, and I'm glad to be distributing my films that I'm passionate about in the way that I am. So I don't have any complaints. I'm glad of it ultimately.
And how long do you plan on touring like this? Is there a set time limit, or you're going to do it until you can't do it no longer?
It's right. It's indefinite. Health is important. As long
right.
as I'm healthy, I'm able to do it, and I feel pretty healthy. So I hope to be able to be doing it for a long time. And you know, I don't put the films out on DVD, so it makes them exclusive to the shows.
Right.
And again, if people have just tuned in, the way to know about where I am with my films and shows, the best way to know is by signing up for the newsletter on CrispinGlover.com. And there's also a list of knowing, and there's an official Crispin Holly and Glover Facebook page, a Crispin Glover Twitter, but the best way to know is by CrispinGlover.com.
And Crispin, your biggest role is George McFly in Back to the Future with Michael J. Fox. Talk about what that role did for your career.
Well, I started acting professionally when I was 13, which was 1977. So I acted in Back to the Future in the year 1984. So I'd already been acting for a number of years. I didn't work a lot when I was a teenager, really. Until I turned 18, I had decided to become an actor around the age of 13. My father's an actor. My mother retired as a dancer and an actress when I was born. So I'd been kind of raised understanding how the business worked. My parents never pushed me into it, but it was something I realized I could do at a relatively young age.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a funny thing to say, but age 13 is actually it's kind of an old age to start for a child actor. So I didn't really work a lot when I first started acting, because really there were a fair amount of established child actors, and I hadn't done very much. So I didn't really start working a lot until I turned 18, and the child labor laws started working in my favor. And then I did start working, you know, quite a bit. I'd done not a huge amount of films, but I'd done a number of films before I'd been in Back to the Future, and some television as well. But when I got the role, of course, I knew it was a big Universal Studios film, and Steven Spielberg was executive producing. So I knew it was a very good role as well. Although actually, I was not given the entire screenplay before the negotiations for me to be in the film were done. So I actually didn't know the entire extent of the role until I was
wow.
actually there working. I had been told that I would be playing the elder characters as well by my agent, but when I auditioned for the part, I only auditioned for the younger character. So, of course, it was a great role, and I could tell that it was a film that was probably going to do well, just by the nature of who was producing it, and that it was a Universal Studios film, and then it did do very well. I was away acting in a different film when it came out. I was working on a film with Sean Penn and Christopher Walken called At Close Range, which I started just not too long after we finished the shooting of Back to the Future. And the initial actor that was playing the son character was fired from the film. So there were a lot of reshoots, but they had gotten the film together relatively quickly. So it came out within just a number of months after we had finished shooting, within about 6 months, I would say, because I think we finished it in spring, and then it came out in summer. And I was away in Tennessee working on this film, so I didn't actually see the film until I got back. I wasn't able to go to the cast or crew screening, so I went to Cinerama Dome and paid for a ticket to go see the film. And I could definitely immediately tell a difference in the recognizability factor. I'd experienced being recognized before that, for certain. But of course, that film was so very popular; it was quite a jump and differentiation of what I'd experienced from before being in that film.
We're talking to actor Crispin Glover. And Crispin, you did Back to the Future, the first one, but things really didn't work out for Back to the Future 2. Is there any ill will about that to this day, or it is what it is?
It's very complex, actually, and I have complex feelings about it. As far as not being in the sequels, that was not something I had difficulty with, and I had not come to an agreement with the producers about monetarily about coming back. What is unfortunate is what subsequently happened is that the producers did something that was it was illegal. They did not reach a financial agreement with me, and they hired another actor, which that part's legal. But what they did was they took the casts of my face from the original molds that were taken to do the old age makeup in the first film, and they sculpted prosthetic nose, chin, and cheekbones to replicate my face, and they applied these prosthetics onto this other actor in order to make that actor look like me in the second film. And then they spliced a very small amount of footage of me from the original film with a majority of, by far, what the other actor that played the role. But unfortunately, they weren't playing the role. They put prosthetics on this actor to make him up to look like me, and then intersplice this footage of me from the original film to fool audiences into believing that I was in the film. And the producers owned the character of George McFly. That was something they wrote, but they didn't write my facial features, and they didn't own me or my facial features.
Right.
So I had a lawsuit about it, which I really there were two things that were important. First off, it was very important. I wanted people to know it wasn't me in the film. And the way it had been done was it made people believe. There are still people that think I was in the sequels to the movie, but which is I don't like, because I didn't act that role. There's another actor acting it. And if I had acted it, I would have played it differently. And so because of my lawsuit, there are laws in the Screen Actors Guild now that make it so producers, actors, directors can never do something like that again. But beyond that, unfortunately, there's a bitterness, I feel like, from one producer in particular named Bob Gale, who is one of the architects of this illegal action. And I think that he's bitter about it, because he's somebody that he after the lawsuit, if you really look at his career, he didn't work a lot more in the film industry, and I think he genuinely is bitter about it, and he continually says negative things about me that are not true, particularly on the Back to the Future DVDs. He's claimed that the reason I wasn't in the sequel is because I demanded the same salary as Michael J. Fox, and it's total fabrication. It has nothing
right.
to do with reality. And so, you know, to have been really technically stolen from, and then to have people say untrue things about you to cover up their illegal actions is just, that's really intolerable. And I didn't talk about it for many years, just because I thought it was better to be silent. But
right.
he's been doing this very recently on the Blu-ray release of Back to the Future. He kind of upped his stories, and it's just intolerable. So now I have to talk about it. It's unfortunate because, you know, the work in the original film, you know, all of these years later, if that film was the only film that existed, I'd be, you know, perfectly happy, glad that I was in the film, glad that people still like it and all of that. And, you know, I do feel like that essentially. But what happened subsequently was truly wrong by the producers, and to be not classy enough to either stay silent about it, or if you're going to talk about it, at least tell the truth and admit that they did something wrong.
Right.
But to do something where I'm being put in a bad light by the people that actually did something that was illegal is just I've got to clear that air, and it's too bad because of course there are millions of people that listen to those DVDs, and they believe what the producer of these things will say, even though that producer was somebody that, you know, did something that was illegal, and now they're lying about it to cover it. I really don't like. But, you know, as far as people coming up to me and talking about that film, or of course I've been in a lot of other films as well, when people come up and talk to me, usually it's because they've seen me in many different films. So,
right.
you know, I think of that film as something, I'm glad I was in the film. It's good that I was in the film. It's good for my career now. It's good for my tours. People want to come and see the shows because of all of the various works I've done in the corporate industry, and I'm glad of all of it.
And real quickly now, would you ever do any type of fan convention with the Back to the Future cast?
Well, the problem is that if I go and do that, ultimately I'm sponsoring the sequels. And
okay.
because I had an illegal action against me, it would be sponsoring this illegal action. And
right.
unfortunately, I can't do that.
Right.
You know, I've been invited to those things. But, you know, if people really want to meet me and that kind of thing, I tour around with my own shows, like I say, with my own films. And CrispinGlover.com is a very easy way for people to know. So I'm ultimately very accessible, but I do have to be specific in the way I do it because with that film, there are other films I go and support. I'm going to be in London. Sundance is doing an initial kind of London version of their show. Their festival in the middle of this upcoming month, and I'll be in London with a showing of River's Edge, which is a film I'm very proud of. And through the week before that, there's a new film that I'm in, which is based on an Elmore Leonard novel called Freaky Deaky, and I'll be at the Tribeca Film Festival also on a panel about that film as well. So I have a couple of different appearances with other films that I'm in. So, you know, I'm not somebody that's, like, against supporting, you know, past films that I'm in or anything like that. I'm all for it. But it's unfortunate that particular film, which,
right.
of course, is such a well-known film, that the producers did something that was illegal, and I can't support that.
And now, fans, to find out about your tour, CrispinGlover.com, correct?
That's right, yeah. And, I it's great to meet people and talk to people, so if people can come out to the shows, so I look forward to seeing them there.
Crispin, it was a pleasure talking to you, sir. We wish you nothing but the best of luck with everything that you're doing. And let's do this again.
Absolutely. I'm all for it. I
take care.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
Crispin Glover, one of the stars of Back to the Future. It's kind of sad the way that whole story and that whole situation ended for him. Wasn't in the sequel, but it was good to get his insight. And make sure you go to CrispinGlover.com to find out some of the great things that he has going on now. The man is busy. He's on tour. He's been on tour for the last 7 years. So he's having a good old time out on the road again, going places that I've never been. And so CrispinGlover.com is where you can find out some of the great information and some of the great things he has going on. You're listening to Go Forward on BlogTalkRadio.com.
Almeida, a.k.a. Corey Live, host of Picturica on the Hub and warm-up host for American Idol and Dancing with the Stars. And right now, you are listening to Go For It on Blog Talk Radio with my man Paulie G and Jeremy. Get it!
Thank you, sir.
We're back, and again, it was very good to talk to Crispin Glover. Great story there with him, and pleasure talking to him. I want to go back to Greg Williams now. And I look at the whole Greg Williams thing, and I say this. You know, sometimes to get guys to a certain point, you have to rev them up. You have to get them going. And I'm not saying some of the things he was saying was right, because they're not right. They're not right at all. Not even close to being right. But you see, I guess, where his thought process was or in terms of trying to get them hyped and ready to go. But at the same time, like Willie Rose pointed out, if you say those type of things in this day and age, it's going to get you in a lot of trouble. It's going to get you in a whole heck of a lot of trouble. And unfortunately for Greg Williams, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, it got him into a big amount of trouble. Got him into a lot of trouble. So it's an unfortunate situation that happened, had to happen the way it happened. Truly an unfortunate situation, but it's just the nature of the situation sometimes, the nature of the game. And unfortunately, it happened to Greg Williams. And Sean Payton and those guys are all going to pay for what happened. I want to go to Bobby Petrino now for a second. And again, I think as a leader of men, you have to set the standard. And you may say all this temptation that's out there for him and the amount of money. And sometimes, you know, a lot of ways they're big fishes in small ponds. But the reality is you are a leader of men. And your role in a lot of ways is to, as a being a leader of men, your role is to set the standard. And you cannot tell me that he is setting the standard by doing some of the things that he's doing. He's not setting the standard. He is not setting the standard by doing some of the things that he did. He's not. He's not. And that's an issue. And that's a problem. He's not setting the standard. And he needs to do that. He needs to set the standard. He needs to set the standard. And he's not doing that and has not done that. And that's a problem. But I think he keeps his job. Again, he's a head of a top five program, and that's a very good Arkansas team, and he's built a great program there. So I think he stays. I think he survives it. May get suspended a couple games, but he will survive it. He will survive it. I'm almost positive he will survive it, but we'll see. We shall see what happens. And I ended the Greg Williams conversation, but I have to go back to the conversation for a second here. And the reason I'm going back is the filmmaker who filmed the footage and the audio that we heard of Greg Williams, Sean Pamphilon, according to Steve Gleason, the person who the film was about, according to Steve Gleason, Steve said that, you know, Steve said in a lot of ways that the reason behind the whole the reason that he was doing this was to shed light on his situation. He is suffering from ALS at this point, and he wanted to shed light on the situation. But he did not want the footage or the audio to be leaked out there without his permission. He is saying that he did not get permission. We'll get back to that for a moment there. We're going to bring in now former Florida defensive lineman and now NFL draft prospect, Jay Howard. Jay, how are you, sir?
Hey, I'm doing fine.
Thanks for joining us.
Hi, no problem.
And Jay, we talked, and talking about you, you have to talk about versatility. You're a guy that can play various positions on the defensive front. How much will that versatility help you on the next level?
You know, I think it'll be able to help me a lot. You know, teams can utilize me at a 3 technique, and also I can play the 3-4 end, you know, and I can also play nose guard. So I can pretty much play anything to add up to a team.
Is there a preference?
You know, I don't. I play whatever team needs me to play.
Right. And Jay, at the combine, you ran an impressive 4.7540. I mean, you're a 300-pound man, so that's very impressive. Talk about your performance as a whole at the combine.
I felt like I put together a nice showing. You know, I went out there, I wanted to compete, you know, show that I belong at the top, with the top of the guys when it comes to discussion of being the top defensive tackles. So, you know, I just felt like I did a great showing.
And a few weeks later, you had your pro day. How do you feel you fared there?
At pro day, I just basically kept everything that I did from the combine, so it was basically doing drill work, and I excelled at doing the drill, so I think I did a nice showing also.
As you prepare for this draft, kind of take us through a day in the life of Jay Howard.
Right now, I'm just sitting back, working out every day, staying in shape, and just waiting, getting closer to the draft, but just maintaining and staying in football shape.
And looking at you, Jay, I mean, you were a standout at Florida. You put up decent numbers throughout your career. But with this whole draft process, do you feel like you almost have to prove yourself again?
Of course. You know, at the end of the day, the draft is a draft. At the end of the day, you're going to be out there playing against Pro Bowlers, fighting for their livelihoods, So at the end of the day, you're going to have to prove yourself when you get up there.
We're talking to former University of Florida defensive lineman Jay Howard as he prepares for the upcoming NFL drafts. And, Jay, one of your strengths is your ability against the run. Talk about your mindset against the run.
I'm a physical player. I like to put my hands on people, so I'm able to utilize my hands and quickness cause havoc.
And, Jay, I've been reading about what some of the scouts are saying about you. One scout or some of the scouts are talking about your motor, and they also said that you play in spurts. How do you respond to something like that?
I told them to put on my senior year film. I didn't take any plays off. I played hard throughout the season. You guys come back in Florida, ask any of my coaches, starting with the head coach, Coach Muschamp, and Dan Quinn, my defensive coordinator. They'll vouch for me. I played hard. Played hard for them, and they'll vouch for me.
Is it frustrating hearing things like that?
It is, man. It is, because I know I go out there and give it my all, and my stats and my game film show it. It's back from my younger days. Growing up and you take plays off sometimes in your younger days, but I matured and I'm just maturing and I'm ready to excel at the next level.
Jay, the draft is a few weeks away. What do you bring to an NFL team?
I'm sorry. Okay.
What do you bring to an NFL team?
On me, like I said, I'm a player that makes plays behind the line of scrimmage. I'm a hybrid. I can play anything you want me to play on a defensive line. You know, I can adapt to your team. I'm going to be a playmaker. You know, I'm not going to be a guy that just wants to be in a rotation. I'm going to be a guy that's competing for the starting job.
We're talking to former Florida defensive lineman Jay Howard as he prepares for the upcoming NFL draft. And, Jay, right now, some of the projections I'm reading about you, rounds between round 4 and 7 is where you may be drafted. Do you look at the draft boards, or is that something you avoid?
Oh, that's something I avoid. You know, I let my agent handle all that, you know, just sit back and just embrace an opportunity, you know, to even have this opportunity in front of me right now.
Is there a level of nervousness at this point for you? Are you nervous at this time, or are you just like, you just kind of can't wait till it's over, or you just look forward to the process?
I mean, it's a little nerve-wracking. You know, you think about it, you try not to, but, at this point, I'm just embracing it, you know, taking it day by day.
Right, and that's all you really can do. Jay, I want to play a game called Getting to Know You. You know, you're an NFL draft prospect, you're preparing for the draft, and you're going to be on somebody's roster. So the fans need to get to know you a little bit. You ready to play?
All right, I'm ready.
Jay Howard's favorite food?
Hot wings.
Hot wings, okay. Mild or hot?
Just hot.
Just hot, okay.
Yeah.
Your favorite toy growing up?
My favorite toy probably have to be my pellet gun.
Your favorite team growing up?
My favorite team, football?
Yes.
Probably the Cowboys.
Okay. Your favorite NFL player?
Donovan Sue.
Okay. All right. And lastly, your favorite crush growing up?
I don't know. That's a hard one to say. You know, I can't even say that one. I don't want to get into that one.
Jay, again, we wish you nothing but the best of luck, man, as you prepare for the upcoming NFL draft. How can fans connect with you? Do you have a Twitter?
Oh, no, I don't have a Twitter at all. I have a Facebook, so you can just look me up on that Facebook, Jay Howard.
Okay, make sure you friend him on Facebook. You will friend him back. You will accept their friendship.
Yeah.
Jay, it was a pleasure talking to you, man. We wish you nothing but the best of luck moving forward. And, again, I love to talk to you again. Let's do this again.
All right, appreciate it.
Take care.
All right. Well.
Jay Howard, defensive lineman, former defensive lineman for Florida, as he prepares for the upcoming NFL draft. And it is right around the corner. Seems very confident in his abilities. And you look at it, and he talked about it. But I think I would be a little angry and upset if people were questioning me about some of the things that I'm doing, even if it's not true, especially if it's not true. You know, I mean, somebody's questioning your ability, questioning your motor. Basically, they're saying you're taking plays off. And to me, that would be upsetting to me. And I think, you know, with his situation, he was not happy with that. And I wouldn't be happy with that at all either. I mean, that's not something to be happy over. But again, I think he's going to, on the next level, because of his versatility, he is going to be in somebody's rotation. He may not start, but he's going to be in somebody's defensive line rotation. So I think that's what we'll have with Jay Howard on the next level. Again, his projections are anywhere from 4 to 7 at this point. He's definitely going to get drafted. It's just a matter of when. And hopefully he'll go to the team that can utilize his skill set the best. And hopefully he will have a successful NFL career. Good guy. Seems like a very good guy. And we wish him nothing but the best of luck on the next level. And the next level is right around the corner for him. I mean, it's truly right around the corner. Right around the corner for this guy. I mean, the draft is here. Or should I say it's approaching, but it's darn near here. And, you know, as guys prepare for the draft, you know, I think there has to be some nervousness going on there, you know, some uneasiness, because this is going to change your life for the rest of your life. I mean, this is a life-altering thing. And so this is something that you're coming out of college, and now you're about to go into your profession. You're about to go into your profession. And that's what he's going to do. He's going into his profession. And his profession is NFL football. And, again, we wish him nothing but the best of luck with that, and hopefully he will be successful on the next level. And, again, I think he will be in somebody's rotation. I think he will be in somebody's defensive line rotation. But, again, I want to go back to Greg Williams and this whole bounty thing. You look at it, and, again, Steve Gleason, who the film was supposed to be about, and the director was Sean Papillon, who the film was supposed to be about Steve Gleason and his whole situation right now. And, again, he's upset that the audio was leaked, and he believed and he stated that the Saints trusted him and gave him a lot of access. They trusted him and gave him great access to the team and everything. And so he, in a lot of ways, did not want this to get leaked. And he felt like, in some respect, I mean, he's upset about it. He's truly upset about it. I mean, in his statement, he talked about feeling frustrated and distracted. He talked about being deflated and disappointed. He just sort of, I mean, he says that this is his footage. And, yes, this footage can only be released with his permission. And he didn't give Papillon permission to release that footage. He's saying he didn't give him permission. In his statement, he talked about, he said, I included Sean Papillon in some of these activities because I felt my relationship with the Saints was an integral part of my overall journey. The Saints trusted me and gave me unlimited access in filming, and I, in turn, trusted Sean Papillon. So there you have it. He trusted him, trusted Mr. Papillon, and in that trust, from that trust and from that situation, ultimately, it's a tough situation for Gleason. I mean, you feel for him in a lot of ways. If what he's saying is true, you really do feel for the guy. You really do. Because it kind of takes away from what he wanted with his story and how he wanted his story to be told. He's doing this to get his story told. He's doing this to get his story told. Steve Gleason, we're talking about. And he trusted Sean Papillon. He trusted him and trusted that he would do the right thing with the footage that he gathered. He thought he entrusted him to do the right things with the footage that he gathered. And unfortunately, in some respect, you could argue that Papillon did not do the right things with those footage, and I guess the right thing with that footage would be, in some respect, not releasing that audio, especially audio that you did not want to be released and audio that you thought was not going to be released, and you thought in a lot of ways that the access that they granted Papillon, you didn't think he would use it in that manner. Let's bring in now Pro AMA National Series racer, the one, the only, Shalina Morito.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And I said Morito, it's Moreto.
Moreto,
so I do apologize for that.
Like my grandfather says, call me anything you want, just don't call me late for dinner.
And Shalina, I got to ask, where did this passion for motorcycle racing come from?
Well, my dad raced motorcycles and raced cars when I was growing up, and he still races dirt bikes. And so kind of watching my dad out there race developed a love for racing for me. And my dad instilled in us kids that we could do anything that we wanted, and if we made goals and worked hard and followed them, we could achieve whatever we wanted, you know. And he didn't know that was going to turn into a love for racing for me, but that's what it did. He got me, it was his fault, he got me on motorcycles when I was really young. So so
and
I blame this whole thing on him.
And looking at it, I mean, you are one of three females on the Pro AMA National Series.
Yeah.
Because of that, do you feel any extra pressure?
Yeah, a little. I mean, a little bit, because you've got a lot of eyes on you, but that just makes it more fun, you know. I mean, the pressure is what drives you to do good. So, I don't mind it a bit.
And there's a lot of firsts when it comes to you. You were the first female to race at Indy, the first female to race on an electric bike internationally.
Yep.
How honored are you to have all these firsts attached to your name?
I mean, it's awesome to me. It's not what I'm out there to do. I'm out there just to race. So these are just frosting on the cake for me. I mean, it's amazing. I didn't even know that I was going to be the first girl to ever race Indy on a motorcycle until I had already committed to racing there. And it was my first time ever riding a Harley. I was the first girl to race a Harley at the AMA XR 1200 class. And so I get there and I'm practicing on the bike, and they go, "By the way, we're gonna have an interview for you because you're gonna be the first girl to ever race a motorcycle at Indy." And I'm like,
wow.
"Great, no pressure. You want to talk about added pressure?" That was it.
I can imagine. I definitely can imagine. And talk about racing a motorcycle at such high speeds. I mean, I got to be honest. I'm afraid to jump on a motorcycle. Never been on one. So talk about it.
I love it. I mean, it's a thrill. The speed's a thrill for sure. Last week, 2 weeks ago, I guess, I got to race at Daytona. My top speed there was just over 175 miles an hour. Pretty fun. And the weird thing about it, though, I mean, the bikes are set up really well. The suspension's awesome on them. And I'm on the banking of Daytona going, like I said, $175, and just wanting more because, I mean, it feels so smooth. And the track's smooth. It's set up for it. That's what the bike wants to do. So I love it.
And, Shalina, right now you qualified for your first pro race in 2010. You're still young in this sport.
Uh-huh.
Do you feel like now you're starting to gain some respect?
Yes, finally. It's a hard sport to break into. Racing isn't easy, just like any other pro athlete, I guess. You're one of a million that are trying to get there, you know? And nobody's going to take you seriously if you're just out there in the beginning, and you got to put the time in, just like everything else. And so now that I've been out there, I'm improving my times and everything else, yeah, people are starting to take me a little bit more serious, I guess, and I'm also have a big sense of accomplishment because my goal was to race AMA. I only started racing 3 years ago, and I made it to that goal, and then my goal was to race the international level. I got there, so I'm just making new goals every day, pushing.
We're talking to motorcycle racer Shalina Moreta. And Shalina, I mean, you're a trailblazer in many ways. You are a trailblazer.
Thank you.
Is it your hope that little girls around the world will want to get involved with this sport because of you?
My focus isn't on little girls so much. It's on everybody, little girls, little boys, everybody. This is if I could give a message to them, it's follow your dreams. You know, work hard to get where you want to go. And if you put your mind towards anything, you can accomplish anything that you want. So, I mean, yeah, I hope that little girls see that message, but I hope that little boys do too. I'm not out here to prove for the girls, out here to chase dreams.
And the season is underway for you. I mean, you've had some decent finishes in 2011.
Yep.
What do you hope to accomplish in 2012?
2012, I'm working on getting top 10 for the super sport class. I want to drop my times enough to know that I will be competitive in the Daytona Sport Bike class, which is the next highest class in the AMA. And my goals are ever-changing. As soon as I attain one, I'm on to the next one. So I've got some big goals for the electric bike races, the international races. Those are a new big thing coming out, and as well as progressing in the AMA.
Talk about riding an electric bike.
Everybody is curious about the electric bikes, it seems, because they're so new. And to be really honest with you, when about 2 years ago, I thought that electric, those got to be really lame, you know. But then they asked me to race one, and, well, I'm a racer, so I'm like, okay, I'll do it. And I stuck my foot in my mouth because they're cool. They're not like what my stereotype of them was. They're fast. They're almost as fast as the 600s. Last year at Laguna Seca, they were only 1 second off pace of the fastest 600s. So they're getting there, and this year they may even be faster than the fastest 600s. Their suspension is getting similar to the regular combustion engines, like the petrol bikes, and the feel of them is really close. So I'm excited. Their potential is not even tapped yet either, so it's an awesome angle of the sport to be a part of.
And you talked about decreasing your times in the 2012 season. What have you done in the off season to make that happen? Take us through like a practice session.
I have been working hard this off season. I partnered up with Supermoto USA, who does like flat track style training. Typical day with them, I will go to the track, we'll do some stretching and whatnot, and then you go out and you ride flat track dirt bikes like all day long, and they push you and they make you do drills and you learn how to slide the bike. Sliding the bike is important for street bikes because you are going to break loose on the rear tire sometimes, so you got to know how to react, right? So you
right.
learn through flat track, you learn the feel of the bike. When I'm not doing flat track, I'll do things like CrossFit, I'll go for a run, I'll do bicycle riding, both on the street and dirt riding. And I just try and stay busy, like doing different things, because I get bored if I just do, I can't say do just the gym thing, I can't do it. So I try and spice it up a little. So that's what
I
my whole off
game.
Season look like.
Go ahead. I want to play a game called Getting to Know You.
Okay.
I want the fans to get to know the real you, the real Shalina. And
all right.
I'm going to start with this. What is your favorite food?
My favorite food is spaghetti. I love spaghetti with red sauce.
Red sauce. Has to be red sauce.
Yes, has to be red sauce.
Okay.
It's healthier that way.
True, very true.
But I love tomatoes. So.
Next thing. What music do you listen to before a big race?
I don't have a pump me up music, but if I do, I'll listen to like rock or something. My favorite pre-race ritual is actually to sit with my bike. You have a bond with your bike, and I'll sit there and I'll go over the track in my head, and that's my pre-race thing. But if I were to pick a type of music, it would be rock.
And talk about that bond with the bike, and talk about that bond. How does explain that?
Well, it's weird for anybody that doesn't race. I don't know. It's like you have this connection with the bike, right? Like you spend a lot of time with it, and you know that bike. You know the way that it works. You know where the controllers are. You know the way that the foot pegs fit you. And it's just like any other piece of machinery. You have a special bond you can relate, like, with your car. A lot of people, if you sell your car, you're upset because you missed that car, right? Well,
definitely.
This motorcycle is, like, a part of you. It's an extension of you, and that thing is taking you around the track at 150, 170 miles an hour. You trust that motorcycle. And so before every race, I'll sit with it and might sound silly, but I'll go over with the bike, like the course and what we're about to do. We're about to go do a big thing together, you know?
Right, and I guess truly as a racer, that's something I really couldn't understand. That's something that only a racer can understand.
A racer or anybody that drives a car, everybody has a special bond with their vehicle, I think, you know?
Right. I would agree with that.
Definitely.
You put it in simple terms and talking about the vehicle. Everybody, for the most part, has a car. And you're right. You do become connected with that car. There is a bond that you have
with
the car.
You like
it. So
and it likes you,
sense.
You hope.
Hopefully it likes you. Hopefully.
Yeah.
And the final question, your favorite vacation spot?
My favorite vacation spot is anywhere tropical. I adore Okinawa, Japan, actually. I love the warmth. I love humidity. I'm from California, so we have nice weather here. But if I can get into a tropical climate any day of the week, I'm going to do it.
Now, Shalina, where can fans connect with you?
I'm on Twitter at Shalina93. 93 is my race number. I'm also on Facebook at Shalina Morata Racing, and my website is SheesRacing.com, SHEZ. Just to make it different.
And they can also find your race schedule on that website as well?
Yep, my race schedule is on shesracing.com.
And
sure.
When is the next race for you?
The next race for me is going to be on Cinco de Mayo weekend out here at Infineon Raceway. I'll be racing the R6 with the AMA, and I'll also be out there with the electric bike team. I won't be on electric bike that weekend, but the electric bikes will be there for everybody to come check them out.
Wow.
And also, if anybody wants to check out that track, I've got a video on YouTube. If you search GoPro Shalina Moreta, you can see a pretty sweet video from Infineon Raceway.
Shalina Moreta, it was a pleasure talking to you. We wish
thank
you nothing but the best of luck. Let's do this again. Good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you so much, Paul. Have a good day. I
you
appreciate
too.
It.
Shalina Moreta, motorcycle racer. AMA, motorcycle racer. I can't even get that out. I cannot say AMA without stumbling. But it was a pleasure talking to her. We wish her nothing but the best of luck. And they're an interesting sport. I mean, it's something that I was not all too familiar with, but it's definitely an interesting sport. And again, we wish her nothing but the best of luck with that. And in some respects, it's probably a dangerous sport, being that you are racing motorcycles at such a high speed. So, very interesting. Very interesting sport. And we wish her nothing but the best of luck moving forward. And hopefully she can make some big things happen this season. I'll be rooting. I truly will be rooting for her to make some things happen this off season. So we'll see. We shall see what happens with that. Another 4 minutes to go in the show. Great show. A lot of great guests today, as always. Good time. We talk sports. We had some fun doing it, as always. That's what we like to do at this time. All the time. And so now you look at things. Tim Tebow. Easter is tomorrow, and Tim Tebow will be speaking at a church tomorrow in Texas. He is set to speak in front of 20,000 people tomorrow in Texas. He's going to give, I guess, a sermon in some respect. And he will be giving that on Easter Sunday, Resurrection Sunday, however you believe. I tend to call it Resurrection Sunday. Some people call it Easter Sunday, but it is what it is. But anyway, Tebow will be speaking there in front of 20,000 people. So you know, well, the church is always crowded on Easter. Church is always crowded on Easter. But you know the church will be extra crowded on Easter. So it should be a good old time for people to listen to the gospel of Tim Tebow. And he's going to give a speech, and we'll see. Wonder how long it's going to be. I'm just looking at it. You get the sense that it's going to be almost a sermon of sorts. I'm getting the sense it's going to be a sermon of sorts that Tebow is going to give the masses in Texas. So it should be interesting to see what Tebow says and does and what kind of speech Tebow gives and how much it will inspire many to do great things. And the Masters, speaking of great things and speaking of a great tournament, the Masters is going on right now. And Tiger Woods, I know everybody wants to hear about him. He still is +3, and that's not a good thing. And he's struggling. He started the day with a couple birdies, but now he's struggling a little bit. And you look at it, this is moving day here at Augusta. And right now, Tiger is not doing any moving. He's moving down, and, you know, +3. Started the day well, but now he's running to a rough spot, rough patch. And if Tiger is not in contention, the next noise you will hear is all the TVs turning away from the Masters. Tiger Woods is golf, and golf, people love Tiger Woods and what he brings to the golf, the game of golf. And so TVs will be turned off around the country. We want to thank Shalina Moreta for stopping by. Make sure you follow her on Twitter at Shalina93. Also want to thank the great Willie Rowe for stopping by. Also want to thank actor Crispin Glover for stopping by. Make sure you check him out, CrispinGlover.com. And also Justin Blaylock of the Atlanta Falcons. Make sure you go to his website, JustinBlaylock.com. And Jay Howard, former Florida defensive lineman, preparing for the upcoming NFL draft. We wish him nothing but the best of luck. Follow him on Facebook at Jay Howard. You can listen to this show and other great shows at blogtalkradio.com/BGAN, where you can listen to this show and other great shows. For everybody here at Go Forward, we wish you nothing but the best of luck. Happy Easter. Have a great night. See you later. Take care. Bye.